ComingToBook.com.
Hello, once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Monday, February 27th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're going to go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Glad to have you with us here to kick off another week of Bang the Book Radio. Should be a fantastic one. We've got conference tournaments starting here tonight. We're back into the full swing of the NBA season. We'll chat some NHL and some Major League Baseball along the way. We'll have all kinds of stuff coming your way here this week on Bang the Book Radio. One thing I do want to bring to your attention here at the top of today's show, I'll try to remind you of this here as we go along throughout this week. Looking at just cramming the shows in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of the next 2 weeks. That will not be this week, but with so much going on with conference tournaments and March Madness, I don't know what our listener counts are going to look like for Thursday and Friday. I don't know how we'll be able to do with getting some of our handicapper guests on and some of our other guests that, you know, of course, want to watch basketball, or they're sending out plays, betting themselves, whatever the case may be. So it looks like we'll just go March 6th, 7th, and 8th of that week, and then March 13th, 14th, and 15th of that week. We'll have some extended shows, though. We'll try. I'm working to schedule our late week guests to come on earlier in the week. So we'll probably be looking at some hour and a half or 2 hour shows there early in the week. But I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And again, I will try to remind you of that here as we go throughout this week. As far as today's show goes, I'll be joined here in a couple seconds by Philip Rosenreich of Orlando Magic Daily. We'll recap the trade deadline, chat a little bit about what happened over the weekend, and then start to take a look ahead for some of the teams, especially those that made deals. Second half of today's show, our handicapping the hardwood segment with Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. As I mentioned, conference tournaments getting underway here tonight, so we'll start to have some thoughts on those. We've got some futures odds out there for some of those tournaments, and we'll chat a lot about what's going on the remainder of the regular season with those teams that have not started the postseason yet. So without further ado, we'll bring on today's first guest. That is Mr. Philip Rosenreich of Orlando Magic Daily. Philip, how's it going today, man?
It's going good. How are you doing?
Doing very well. It is an extremely busy time of year for me. I'm sure it's busy for you as well. Let's go ahead and dive right in here. I mean, I guess the starting point for us might as well be this huge deal between the Pelicans and the Kings, DeMarcus Cousins to New Orleans, Buddy Hield, and a package of other assets going out to Sacramento. Initially here, I know we're sort of kind of, you know, working back to a week ago already at this point. But in terms of that deal, what surprised you the most about it?
First off, it surprised me that New Orleans was even in the running for him. I mean, I think a lot of people kind of figured Sacramento was looking for some more long-term assets, maybe bringing back a quasi-star in return or something that would keep them relevant. I mean, Sacramento is not that far out of the playoff race. I mean, I even thought with all the comments coming out of Sacramento the week before that they were set to re-sign him and were set to make him their franchise player and figure out a way to build around him. Certainly, I think it was in Cousins' financial interest to stay there. But he also, and a lot of people probably don't know this, he has a very deep connection to that city. He does a lot of charitable work that doesn't get publicized a lot, and a lot of it's because he doesn't want it publicized. I think that it was just surprising to see the deal happen, and then surprising to see New Orleans be the team that pulled it off. I mean, I didn't picture them as a team with a ton of assets or even – the right draft pick to try and get a player like Cousins into the fold. And so bringing him in, pairing him with Anthony Davis was just a complete shocker.
Well, and as things have turned out here, since that deal was completed and since games resumed, the Pelicans have lost three straight. And now they're 3.5 out in the Western Conference. And it's more about now the number of teams that they have to jump as opposed to the number of games they are behind, because they're actually 13th now in the Western Conference. They're only ahead of the Lakers and the Suns. We knew that there would be an adjustment period. You've got two guys that are high usage players that want the basketball. How long is this thing going to take to come together?
You know, this is kind of the lawyer in me talking. It depends. I mean, I think it's going to be a lot of figuring out how to play with each other. I mean, Anthony Davis has played with another center for most of his career, and so has DeMarcus Cousins. But they were both kind of low usage centers. They didn't need the ball in their hands a lot. They didn't need to kind of share the ball with them. Now they have two bigs who need to be closer to the basket. Both can shoot jumpers. They're much more effective when they're posting up closer to the basket. Now they need to figure out how to space the floor properly, how to play off each other better, and just how to learn new teammates. I really think they're changing a lot of their style. And on top of all that, New Orleans kind of gutted their depth a little bit to get DeMarcus Cousins. And so a lot of players for the Pelicans on the perimeter have to step up in a way that maybe they weren't asked to before this point and play at a higher level if they're going to jump all those teams and then make the playoffs.
So the Pelicans, by the time they play again, it'll be Wednesday evening. They'll be at home against the Detroit Pistons. They'll have had 2 full days off, so 2 days of really good practices here with the personnel. Is this an issue that can be fixed in practice, would you think? Or do you feel like, you know, this is something that's really only going to come together via game reps?
You know, I think it's something that you can definitely fix in practice. I mean, the one way that's always been explained to me is when you have a team trying to figure itself out, or at least when it's struggling at first, practice is the opportunity to stop things and correct mistakes. So if the team was making mistakes, in games, they can run through it in practice, stop play, reset, correct the mistake, and figure out the way they need to play. And not only that, they can just play and experiment a little bit more in practice than obviously they can in games, because in games, the result matters. In practice, you know, if they want to scrimmage a certain way or a certain lineup, Alvin Gentry can do that now and see how it works before employing in the game. I think what this is all getting to is some trades, teams click immediately and they play really well, and practice can actually harm them. I've seen teams that go on long winning stretches after trade, you know, get a few days off to practice and the coach over tinkers a bit and they kind of fall back down to earth. This is a situation in New Orleans where they're clearly still figuring out what they have, and a few days of practice, I think, can help them kind of work out some of the kinks and get a little bit stronger footing heading into their next game.
All right, let's look at the other side of this coin there. Wow, I can't even talk today. We'll look at the other side of the coin here with the Sacramento Kings. So the Kings, they rally their first game out of the All-Star break and the trade deadline. Big 16-point win over Denver, and obviously Denver, a team with a lot to play for, and they were playing as well as anybody heading into the All-Star break. Then Sacramento loses that little bit of a mental edge or an emotional edge, whatever the case may be, and they do not play well against the Charlotte Hornets, a team that you know and that we've talked about here on the show has really been struggling a lot lately. What do you look at here long-term for Sacramento? I mean, was that just kind of the outlier with that win over Denver and, you know, this is a team that's really going to go in the tank here, or do you feel like there's still that ability for this team to rally?
It's going to be really, really, really interesting because Sacramento is such a young team now. They're no longer a team that's gunning for the playoffs. They've got a lot of young guys. They're relying pretty heavily on Buddy Hield. They brought Willie Cauley-Stein more prominently into the rotation. They've still got that mix of vets. So, you know, Darren Collison and Aaron Aflalo are still around. I think it's going to be really hard to really peg the Sacramento Kings. They're going to be kind of inconsistent at the start. They could go on a streak. I mean, certainly I think there's a lot of emotion in that first game after the trade, and the Kings played like it and played at a very high level. They could play like that on occasion still. They could play like that for a little stretch of time. But I think ultimately talent's going to kind of bring them back down to earth. Their talent level isn't particularly high, and so they'll have their struggles and struggle to win just because they just don't have the players to compete on a night-to-night basis anymore.
Well, and I think a pretty good illustration of it here tonight. Sacramento, a 5-point home underdog to the Minnesota Timberwolves, who are 8-18 on the road here this year. Of course, the T-Wolves have underachieved quite a bit this season, but the fact that they're an easy favorite out there in Sacramento, I think that's a pretty good indication of what the odds makers think here about this Kings team right now. How about the Houston Rockets? So we talk about a trade where a player just, you know, it takes some time. You really have to adjust with that Cousins and Davis situation in New Orleans. So Lou Williams goes to the Houston Rockets. No adjustment necessary here. The Rockets are just putting up huge numbers. Williams with 44 points over his 2 games. Seems like this one's a pretty good fit.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's working so well. This was just the absolute perfect fit. Lou Williams is a kind of shooting guard, point guard, great 3-point shooter, comfortable coming off the bench, great at attacking and dishing back out to the perimeter. This is just manna from heaven for Mike D'Antoni. This is a perfect Mike D'Antoni player. And that system, especially when you have the skills that Lou Williams has, you slide in just comfortably into that role. And so it's not surprising to me to see Houston kind of not miss a beat and just add this player that fits them perfectly. I mean, certainly maybe it takes a little playmaking pressure off of Eric Gordon off the bench. And makes them an even more dangerous team offensively than they already were, which is, you know, pretty crazy to say.
Are we underestimating or maybe underappreciating Houston? I know it's crazy to say that about a 42-18 team, but it still feels like there aren't a whole lot of people giving them a chance, particularly against Golden State. I think if they played San Antonio, you'd have some fairly split opinions. But are people too low on a team that's 24 games over 500?
You know, I actually think so. You know, I think that there's still – I think this kind of gets into a lot of the philosophical battles that you see kind of play out around the league right now. There's still a big current of thought, and it's probably still true, and I think we'll find this out in the playoffs, that, you know, defense matters, and Houston is not the greatest defensive team. I think they're better than probably people give them credit for defensively, but their offense is so overwhelming this year. The way they've been playing offensively, shooting the ball, has been incredible. And they hit a little bit of a rough spot before the All-Star break where they weren't making shots at quite the clip they were before. But their capabilities on offense are going to be really tough to game plan for in a seven-game series. You might catch them on a bad shooting night for one game. But more likely than not, they're going to put a lot of pressure on your defense with three-point shooting. And I think they're, you know, certainly the regular season, they're kind of doing what they're doing. But I think a lot of the opinion is, oh, when they get into the playoffs, they're not going to be able to do this. Defenses are going to step up and find a way to stop them. I'm not so sure that anyone's going to find a way to slow them down completely. And so you've got to raise your offensive game to a new level in a seven-game series. And so I think where people are sleeping on Houston is their capability to win seven-game series and to make noise in the playoffs. Their strategy is kind of going to be to outscore Golden State. I don't know if that's going to work particularly well, because Golden State's actually a very good defensive team. Golden State has all the offensive capability of Houston with the defense, but Houston's going to make any defense look silly. Even a team as good as Golden State, even a team as good as San Antonio. And so I think where people are sleeping on Houston is this belief that defenses are going to all of a sudden figure them out once the playoffs begin. It may take a game. It may take two games to figure out Houston's offense and how to stop it. And that might be enough to get them some series, to get them, you know, ahead in a few series, or even get them to surprise a team that no one expects. So I would keep an eye on Houston, because in today's NBA, I mean, this is, you know, if you run through the numbers, defense has been the worst it's been in a very, very long time in the NBA this year. Offenses are thriving. They've kind of figured out how to stretch defenses thin. Houston, as much as anyone, and that could be a trend that we see heading into the end of the season, and especially in the playoffs.
I think you're referring to a tweet that I saw in passing yesterday. I believe nobody in the league has a defensive rating below 100.
I believe that is correct now.
That's remarkable to me. And again, we'll have to see. I mean, you know, the old adage has always been defense wins championship. Well, you know, the definition of defense has changed a little bit here in the NBA, to be sure. But speaking of teams that don't play very good defense, go ahead.
Yeah, and typically, if you're a top 10 defense, you're making the playoffs. So not only making the playoffs, you've got a real chance to win as far as defensive rating. If you look at the top 10 defenses in the league this year, Miami is probably not going to make the playoffs. Detroit's the 8th seed. They're 9th in the league in defensive rating. Atlanta's been slipping a lot. They're 5th in defensive rating. Charlotte has been slipping tremendously in the last few weeks. They're 7th in defensive rating. And so, you know, the top defenses are still going to make the playoffs, it seems, but it's not as sure of a thing as it used to be.
Well, the team that sent Lou Williams to Houston, the Los Angeles Lakers, obviously they have a lot of incentive to lose, as we've already talked about. And so far, they're doing a pretty good job of it here coming out of the All-Star break. I mean, this is a team that, you know, has now lost 137-101, 110-93, 119-98 in their last three games. Is this just going to be blowout city for this team the rest of the year?
You know, it certainly does feel that way. I think they're going to probably start playing Brandon Ingram a little bit more, de-emphasize their vets. The Lakers have every incentive to lose games the rest of this year and ensure that they get that second most ping pong balls in the lottery. Because if they don't get a top three pick, they lose that pick, and not only lose that pick, but lose their pick in 2019. And so I think the Lakers, obviously they have a lot of young guys, and I think they want to play those young guys and get them experience and figure out what they have in them. But the Lakers have every incentive to lose, and if they lose big, they lose big, because their talent level is just not particularly high right now. It's going to be a long end of the season for the Los Angeles Lakers, But they're going to be hoping that that nets them a drop, nets them their first round pick for the next, you know, for two of the next 3 years.
All right, let's get to the Washington Wizards here. This was a pretty interesting deal where they pick up Bojan Bogdanovic. They get him from the Brooklyn Nets, and obviously the Brooklyn Nets, you know, have really nothing to play for. I'm not surprised that they sold off whatever assets they could here prior to the trade deadline. Now, the Wizards came into the All-Star break playing extremely well. They were one of the hottest teams in the NBA. Well, they've dropped two straight now coming out of the break, and you know, that it's not really a big surprise. I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit, and actually the team they share a building with, the Washington Capitals, when they ran into their bye week, that was something that they didn't need at all because they were playing at an extremely high level, wanted to keep going to work every day. When you stop going to work, you know, sometimes complacency sets in a little bit. Maybe that's happened here for the Wizards, but do you feel like this trade was a good one for them?
I do ultimately believe it's a good trade. For people who don't follow the Nets or don't go super deep into the NBA, Bojan Bogdanovic is a really capable scorer. If you watched him in the Olympics, he was Croatia's leading scorer, and Croatia made a real surprising run throughout that tournament. It was a lot because of what Bogdanovic does. He's, you know, kind of he's a really good kind of in-between player. He knows how to get his own shot, and he's really worked well in the NBA too as a spot-up shooter. And so I think Washington's figuring out how to play him and how to integrate him into their systems, but he's going to be a player that's going to be able to contribute a lot to them once they get their rhythm back. I think what you said is right. When you head into kind of those bye weeks or into those breaks, I actually had Frank Vogel of the Orlando Magic tell us this before the All-Star break. After the All-Star break, when you're playing well, you don't want the break to happen because you want to maintain your rhythm. When you're playing poorly, you can't wait for that break just to kind of get away and reset the battery a little bit. And so I think we're seeing a little bit of that with Washington. They went on a crazy tear, so they might fall a little bit back to earth, but obviously they're one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference right now.
Well, how much does this move help them? I mean, from the looks of it, they're probably going to finish on that 3 or 4 line. Again, we'll see what happens with Toronto and the injury problems that they have with Kyle Lowry. Can Washington run down Boston? Can they give, you know, Boston or Cleveland a series?
You know, that'll be really interesting to see. I mean, they've got more playoff experience than people think. I mean, John Wall, they're supposed to be an Eastern Conference final contender last year before their season kind of fell out from underneath them. So this is still a very, very dangerous team. You know, I don't know if they're as serious a threat to Cleveland, but certainly they're in that Toronto-Boston group right now where they're, you know, everyone's kind of jockeying for the second best record in the Eastern Conference and the second seed in the playoffs. So I think that there's still a lot to be done for Washington. I still think they need a little bit more shooting to shore things up. And I think Bogdanovic is going to help that, but they've got a lot of work still to do to kind of make sure they're in the right place.
So when you look at the Eastern Conference here, you obviously have the top tier with Cleveland, then a second tier with Boston, Washington, and Toronto. And then I would say Atlanta kind of stands alone a little bit in a third tier by itself. They're 32-26. They're on the 5 line, 2.5 games ahead of Chicago and Indiana, who are currently tied for that 6th and 7th spot. The Hawks made a trade with the Philadelphia 76ers. Who was involved in that, and do you feel like that one helps them out?
Yeah, they traded a Tiago Splitter for Ersan Ilyasova, and this was really a deal, I think, to get them more shooting and kind of downsize a little bit, play a little bit smaller and spread the floor. I think the Hawks, you know, everyone kind of thinks of the Hawks as this team that moves the ball really well, has a lot of shooters everywhere on the floor. And Dwight Howard, you know, for all that he's good at, changed that a little bit. Now they had a true low post threat, a guy who couldn't step out and hit a jumper. And so they had to kind of adjust a little bit of what they did. And I think having a lot of traditional bigs, they have Mike Muscala, who's a center who could step out and shoot a little bit, and Tiago Splitter, a guy who's very much anchored into the paint. I think they needed another stretch four, another shooter to kind of balance their lineup out a little bit. Splitter wasn't playing much for them anyway. They kind of picked Muscala over him. They've got a couple other guys that they like there as well. And Philadelphia came and offered them Ersan Ilyasova, who's an expiring contract anyway. And I think the Hawks saw an opportunity to improve their roster and fill a need and went for it. And you know, it hasn't paid off yet. They've struggled in their first two games since the break. But I think in the long run, Ilyasova is going to help them offensively all the time.
Is this a Hawks team, though, that can go on the road and win that 4-5 matchup in the first round?
It's certainly possible. I mean, I think they've got the talent to do so. But I wouldn't put it as likely. I think they're well behind the Boston, Washington, Toronto group. They're struggling a little bit right now. They have some issues. I think with how they work together, they're not quite the same cohesive unit that they were a few years ago. Things just don't feel right with Atlanta right now. I'm sure that'll change. There's still a long way to go before the end of the season. But the Hawks, I just don't see the Hawks as a team that's going to threaten anyone as a lower seed needs.
So the Chicago Bulls, there was a lot of talk about this team, a lot of whispers and rumors, sort of wondering what would happen here. I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about Fred Hoiberg the last time we had you on the show. Jimmy Butler's name was thrown about as possibly getting traded somewhere. As it turns out, the only move that the Bulls really made was trading Taj Gibson away to the Oklahoma City Thunder. We'll start with the Bulls' perspective here. I mean, what does this trade do for them? Does it send any sort of message?
You know, I'm not really sure exactly what it does for them. I mean, I think they've got Rajon Rondo, they've got Michael Carter Williams. So where does Cameron Payne fit in there right now? Certainly, it could be that they plan on letting Rondo walk this summer, or maybe even letting Michael Carter Williams walk in free agency this summer. And now they feel like they've got a future point guard starter in Cameron Payne. I just don't see where they're going to get him the minutes right now, and especially considering what Chicago sent out. Taj Gibson, they've been trying to trade. I mean, he's been involved in trade rumors pretty much since he got into the league. He's really just a workmanlike player, does a lot of the glue things that a playoff team needs done. I mean, he's one of the reasons why you have to consider Chicago. You would have had to consider Chicago just a little bit dangerous, because he just works hard, and that kind of stuff pays off in the playoffs. Sending him and Doug McDermott out to get Cameron Payne, it felt like a lot. It felt like that the Bulls gave up a lot for a player that doesn't, you know, and I know there are other pieces of that deal, but gave up a lot for a player that I'm having a tough time finding out where his minutes are going to come from, considering the other players on their roster that they might want to play. And so I think it muddies the water a little bit for the Bulls, and it's hard to figure out exactly what direction they're planning on going right now.
Well, and that was the direction I was going to go, actually, is this seems like a deal made for the future. So what does this say about the 2016-17 season for them?
You know, I think it says that the Bulls are still going to try and make the playoffs. I mean, I think Jimmy Butler is playing some really strong basketball right now, and he's going to give you a chance to make the playoffs. And in all likelihood, he's going to be the best player on the floor. And that, you know, the old adage in the NBA is if you have the best player on the floor, you have a chance to win. More often than not, Butler's going to be the best player on the floor. And so Chicago's going to have a shot at winning games, you know, maybe making it a series against whoever they play in the playoffs. On top of that, you know, Dwayne Wade's still Dwayne Wade in a lot of ways. He can still step his game up and play at a really high level. But I think Chicago's still figuring out their future. I don't think they know what to do. And last year, they shopped Jimmy Butler around to see what they could get. It appears they did that again this year at the trade deadline. I'm sure they'll do it again in the summer. And that's kind of where everything's holding right now. I don't know how you, as a free agent, you can say, I want to join the Chicago Bulls until you know what Jimmy Butler's future is going to be with that franchise.
Well, we had some other depth moves here. One of them that was pretty notable, I think it was the last deal actually that happened on the trade deadline. PJ Tucker goes to Toronto. And Toronto, as I talked about already, situation with Kyle Lowry, certainly concerning. DeMar DeRozan was banged up for pretty much the entire first half of the year. When the Raptors are healthy, they're a very good team. But they're not all that healthy right now. What does Tucker do for them?
You know, PJ, I mean, I think the one thing Toronto has been looking for a very, very long time is a defensive-minded small forward who can hit open shots, but is there to guard the LeBron Jameses of the world. They had Terrence Ross, who didn't quite do that. They signed Damari Carroll. He hasn't quite delivered. They drafted Norman Powell. He's had his moment, but hasn't quite done it. In PJ Tucker, they have a player who is quietly probably going to put together an all-defensive team caliber season that no one's going to talk about because he isn't a star and he did a lot of it in Phoenix. This guy is just tough. He just has an innate toughness about him. He really cares about the defensive end, and that's where he makes his money, essentially, is with his defense. And so I really, really love this move. Toronto shored up their defense a lot, and that's something they've really struggled with this year at this trade deadline. You know, you even go back to the Serge Ibaka deal. Serge Ibaka makes them a better defensive team because of his rim protection at the power forward spot next to Jonas Valanciunas. PJ Tucker will also make their defense better. And I think that, I kind of said earlier that defense doesn't matter so much anymore. Toronto's got the offensive weapons to score with anybody, to score with a lot of, with most of the teams in the league. Defensively, they were always very, very shaky. Now I think their defense is going to be significantly better and give them the kind of leeway they need to score enough points to win games. And I don't know if PJ Tucker is a LeBron stopper, but he makes them a much tougher opponent for LeBron and for the Cavs should they meet in the Eastern Conference Finals again.
One team noticeably absent from all the trade deadline fun, the Boston Celtics. We talked about them a lot. I've talked about them with other guests here on the show. It felt like they needed to do something in order to compete with the Cavaliers this year. However, they didn't need to do anything because they're set up nicely for the future now with the bevy of picks and other assets that they have. So from your perspective, Philip, was the trade deadline a failure for Boston, or are you okay with the fact that they didn't do anything?
You know, I'm generally okay with the fact that they didn't do anything. I think that, you know, at some point Boston got to pull the trigger on something. I don't think DeMarcus Cousins was the right deal. I think that they were right to be patient about Jimmy Butler, not kind of rush into a bad deal, because in all likelihood, Jimmy Butler is going to be there in the summer. And I think it's a lot easier to make those big kind of game-changing deals in the summer when you have the chance to bring him in for an entire summer, bring him in for a training camp, really kind of build and shape a roster around them rather than doing it on the fly. I mean, stuff like that, you know, you look at New Orleans, stuff like that can backfire very, very clearly. And Boston is second in the East. They sure, a lot of people don't consider them as threats to the Cleveland Cavaliers right now, but their window is still going to be open. They're not going to lose anything on that front. Yeah, they got to deal with Isaiah Thomas's free agency pretty soon, and he's going to get a pretty nice pay raise considering what he's getting right now. But Boston didn't have the pressure to make a deal at this deadline. They're playing well, probably better than they expected. They've still got a lot of flexibility, and everything they were pursuing at the trade deadline is going to be there at the draft. It's not like they sat on anything and lost opportunities. All those opportunities are still going to be there, and sure, if the Brooklyn pick falls to 4, maybe that makes it a little bit harder, but not much, because this is a loaded draft class, and even 4 is going to get you a good pick. In all likelihood, that Brooklyn pick is going to still end up in the top 3. So I don't think that Boston felt pressure to make a deal. They felt like, you know, let's take a look at everything that's in front of us. Let's make some decisions, and if it doesn't happen now, we can revisit it in the summer. We're not in any rush to make a deal. We have no pressure to make a deal. And so I think generally my opinion is no deal is better than a bad deal. So if you feel like a deal isn't quite what you're looking for and you don't, and you know that it's going to be there later on in the calendar, you sit and be patient, especially when your team is playing as well as Boston is.
All right, well, let's bring this full circle then with regards to the trade deadline. And then I have one other thing I want to ask you here. Who was the big winner then of the trade deadline in your mind? Is there a team that, you know, did enough to really elevate itself and elevate its profile to, you know, make some significant strides?
I think Toronto was the clear winner of the trade deadline. They know their window is open right now. They know they got to re-sign Kyle Lowry this summer. They got DeMar DeRozan locked down. This is kind of their team as it is. And they made their push to the Eastern Conference Finals last year, and they want more. And they pushed their chips in and went after the best – honestly, probably the two best players that were dealt at this trade deadline. Serge Ibaka is – you know, he had his struggles in Orlando, but put him in a playoff environment, and you've seen what he can do. The Oklahoma City Thunder took a 3-1 lead over the Golden State Warriors in that playoff series last year, largely because Serge Ibaka was able to blow up pick and rolls. And so when he raises his play in the playoffs, he's going to be a disruptive force for the Raptors. You look at P.J. Tucker. P.J. Tucker, a lot of casual fans may not know who he is, but he is one of the best defenders in this league and is going to bring a toughness to that team that maybe they didn't have and protect Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan a little bit in those playoff series. I think Toronto addressed a lot of their needs that they had to fill. They improve their defense and improve their team and improve their talent level. And I think that makes – I wouldn't be surprised to see them rise back up to number 2 in the Eastern Conference, or at least get back up to number 3 and set up that series on the other side of the bracket of the Cavaliers.
I guess I lied. I actually have 2 more questions. One of them here is about the free agency that's going on. You know, Andrew Bogut, of course, becomes a free agent. Darren Williams. Now it appears that Brandon Jennings is going to become a free agent as well. You know, we've seen the Cavaliers be pretty interested in some of these free agents, which makes sense. I mean, they were kind of cash-strapped at the deadline. with the luxury tax and all that type of stuff. Any of these free agents going to have a significant impact for their new teams?
You know, I think Deron Williams is going to have a big impact for the Cleveland Cavaliers. A lot of people, I think, have this perception that Deron Williams is kind of washed up. You know, he's not the all-star he used to be. I mean, we used to talk about Deron Williams and Chris Paul together in the same breath. He's not that player anymore. But Deron Williams has had a quietly effective season for the Dallas Mavericks when he's been healthy. And so I think that him going to Cleveland gives them that playmaking point guard that LeBron James has secretly wanted. Backing up Kyrie Irving is kind of a great role for him. And I think that Williams is going to be a big benefit for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Helps them with their depth and their bench a lot because they've had to rely on a lot of young guys that maybe aren't ready for the stage that's about to come to them. Williams is a veteran. He knows what to do. He's been in some of these situations before, and I think he'll be a big boost for the Cavaliers off the bench. And so, you know, Cleveland, you kind of expected them to go into what I like to call the mercenary market. This is a good move for the Cleveland Cavaliers to bolster their team as they prepare for the long run here into the playoffs.
All right, last thing I want to ask you here on this segment, Philip, is, you know, coming out of the All-Star break and the trade deadline can be really challenging. We talked about this a little bit. You mentioned some of the things that Frank Vogel said about, you know, when you're playing well, you want to keep playing. When you're not playing well, you're happy to get that break. Obviously, it's a case-by-case basis, but in more of a general sense here, you know, how long do you think it takes these guys after being off for 7 or 8 days to get back into a rhythm and, you know, for these teams to actually look like they've played together all year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. I don't think anyone can predict that. You know, some teams, you know, come out of the gate fast. Some teams, you know, take a little bit longer to figure things out. I mean, you look at, you know, I'll take two examples that's in Orlando here. You know, entering the Magic Blazers game, I kind of joke that, you know, one of these two teams are going to come out flat. It's just kind of human nature almost. And I would bet it's going to be Portland because they had to go to the East Coast immediately after the All-Star break. And I was proven somewhat correct. Portland did come out a little bit flat. Orlando didn't look great either. And if not for a crazy fourth quarter from Damian Lillard, Orlando probably wins that game, you know, fairly comfortably. You look at Atlanta. Atlanta kind of lost a lot of their rhythm. You know, Dennis Schroeder was late getting back from Germany. He forgot his visa coming back into the country and was late to practice. So he got suspended Friday. The Hawks looked disjointed in that game against the Heat. He came off the bench Saturday as part of the punishment. In Orlando, the Hawks still look disjointed, and it might take a little bit of time for, you know, the Hawks to kind of get themselves back on the mat. You know, it's really no different than the beginning of the season. You know, some teams click immediately, some teams take a little bit of time, but usually, you know, maybe 4 or 5 games into it, teams start settling back into who they were and who they're going to be for the rest of the year. So, you know, some of these early results, I know this is a gambling podcast, some of the early results after the trade deadline, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. You know, you can't really predict it, but, you know, maybe within a week and a half after the All-Star break, teams start settling in. They've played a few more games. They've gotten some practices under their belt, and they're ready for the stretch run, the final 20-some-odd games of the season.
Excellent insight, which is exactly what we've come to expect here from Philip Rosenreich of Orlando Magic Daily. Anything you've written recently, whether it's over at Orlando Magic Daily, fan-sided, anything that you want to point our listeners towards?
You know, I actually just wrote a post yesterday that published today on Step Back about the Magic, you know, kind of finally shifting to a modern NBA team. They shifted Aaron Gordon back to the power forward position, which I know a lot of people were waiting for. If there's any daily fantasy players, you know, Aaron Gordon's back at power forward, so he's probably going to score a little bit more efficiently than he was before. When he was out on the perimeter trying to shoot threes at less than 30%. And so it felt like the Magic kind of learned a lesson that everyone in the league already learned, and now, you know, the Magic might have done it too late.
And you can find Philip on Twitter at PhilRSquared, at OMagicDaily on Twitter is the handle for Orlando Magic Daily. Great podcast over there as well, so if you get a chance to check that out, make sure that you do. But, Philip, we appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, as always.
Great stuff there on the NBA and a recap of the trade deadline there with Philip Rosenreich of Orlando Magic Daily. Before I bring Kyle Hunter on to today's show, just want to remind our listeners about the two great promo code options available over at DSI Sportsbook. Our Bang the Book Radio listeners can use the promo code BTB Radio. They'll get you a $10 free bet just for signing up, and then an additional $50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposit. The other option, the Bang 200 promo code, 100% for the sportsbook, 100% for the live casino. Conference tournaments are coming up. You want to shop around for the best prices in terms of those odds. Of course, you want to get the best prices for the NCAA tournament futures that are out there as well. MLB season win totals, which I'll talk about here at the tail end of the show. All kinds of stuff going on. You want to be able to shop around, get the best prices, not just for futures, but also for games as well, sides and totals. So if you don't have an account over at DSI, we certainly recommend that you check that out. One more segment here left for our Monday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is with Mr. Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Kyle, how's it going today, buddy?
No complaints for me. Conference tournament time here. March Madness, the brackets will be for the NCAA tournament will be printed out here in a couple weeks. So love this time of the year.
Yes, there's plenty to talk about here. Lots of things to get to. We'll see if we can do it all in rapid fire fashion here on today's show. And I guess we got to figure out a starting point first. And I think the starting point would probably be the listener question that I got last week. Something I told him that I would talk about with you. He was mentioning if I only had four stats in terms of coming up with lines for totals, which four would I use? And I think that you and I probably have three of the same. The fourth one, I'm not so sure. But what would be your answer to that question?
Well, number one is definitely tempo. Pace is the most important to me. Some people would say, well, why is tempo more important than offensive or defensive efficiency? I think tempo, it's easier to predict the tempo of a game than it is to predict shooting. And it's the way that I've tried to get an edge over the years, and it's worked out pretty well, is to try to look at recency and project tempos based on recency changes in tempo. So, you know, you look for a team that has changed to start playing faster or a team that's changed to start playing slower, and I try to project that forward. I think that's so certainly tempo is number one for me. Offensive efficiency would be second. Defensive efficiency third. You know, those are basically tied, honestly. You know, the efficiencies. The good thing about those is, you know, it incorporates everything like shooting percentages, turnovers. Obviously turnovers is something you can't overlook when you're looking at offensive efficiency and how good a team's going to be on offense, because even if they shoot the ball really well, if they're turning it over constantly, they're not going to score as many points or be as efficient on offense as they need to be. The fourth one I would say is in just kind of a combined one. I like to look at free throws on offense and defense. How often are they getting to the line and how often are they fouling teams? And I'm saying more about how often they get to the line than I am about their actual percentage at the line. Obviously, that matters as well. But there are some of these teams that I think this is especially good to keep in mind for the teams that foul like crazy. You get some extreme foul fest late in the game. I think those are the better ones to take the first half under and look for a second half over. So in order, I would say tempo, the two efficiencies, and then how often they get to the free throw line, how often they put the other team on the free throw line.
Well, those were the first three that I had. The fourth one that I said, I was kind of torn on a little bit. I thought maybe like offensive rebounding percentage. You're looking for teams that can get those extra possessions, get those easy putbacks. But is that included then in offensive efficiency?
It is included in offensive efficiency. That's the reason why North Carolina can be so efficient on offense, because they're just so good in offensive rebounding. But certainly rebounding is really important. You could also say that, you know, you really want to look at how a team is on defensive rebounding, because there are some teams that are so bad at getting that defensive board. They can give up a ton of second-chance points. Something to also keep in mind is teams that don't rebound well on defense are also going to be fouling a lot, because, you know, you get put-back ability there for the offense and also a lot of and-ones in that kind of situation.
Well, at @Marinara_Joe, we certainly appreciate the question. He actually had a follow-up about what weight we would put on fouls per game as it relates to a total, and obviously you answered that one there all in one, and I didn't even have to ask that follow-up. So I'm glad that question worked out. And if any of our listeners ever do have a question, please feel free to reach out at Skating Tripods on Twitter, at Kyle Hunter Picks on Twitter, or our official at Bang the Book Twitter account. Kyle, I guess let's get into conference tournaments here. This is something that you and I love to talk about. When we were just doing the standalone Handicapping the Hardwood podcast before we included it here in Bang the Book Radio, we would do two, sometimes three of these a week in order to nail down all these conference tournaments. Obviously, both of our schedules a little bit different now at this point than they were back then. But conference tournaments actually begin tonight. The Atlantic Sun begins today. We'll kind of run through all of these here in a little bit of rapid fire fashion. One of the problems with the Atlantic Sun is that these games generally aren't live, so they're not conferences that you spend a ton of time on, but we can use them here to illustrate some of the concepts of betting conference tournaments. You know, this is something that you and I have had a lot of success with in the past, and hopefully we can do it again here for our listeners this year.
Yeah, definitely. We've had a lot of success with this in the past. I've had some listeners reach out here in the past couple weeks and talk about how they've followed along with us in past years on these, and they've done really well. So that's certainly encouraging. And, yeah, I love talking this time of the year. I hate that we don't have more that we can talk about where there's going to be more value today. There's too many really big favorites in these conference tournaments. But if you look at the A-Sun, like you said, I don't spend near as much time on this conference tournament or this conference in general based on the fact that they're not lined usually. I do know some of these teams a little bit. Gulf Coast is a favorite here for good reason. They play good defense. You know, a lot of times when you look at these conference tournaments, what I like to see is teams that are really defensive efficient. You know, defense does really well this time of the year. Another thing you like to see is teams that have scheduled up in the non-conference slate, especially in a small conference like this. Gulf Coast is both of those, but I'm not laying minus 245. I'm never going to lay that kind of price in one of these futures. I guess if I had to find a value team here, it'd probably be North Florida. North Florida has some pretty decent experience, plus 1425. I'm not going to bet this one myself, but that's where I think a little bit of value is.
Well, we can talk in general here then using the Atlantic Sun as an example. For one thing, in a lot of these low major tournaments, games are going to be played at the higher seeded campus. So you don't have a neutral site. You have venues that these players are at least somewhat familiar with. So there's that. Maybe that helps scoring a little bit. It's also, of course, going to influence the betting lines because the home team is going to get home court advantage built in. And actually, I guess I'll ask you that while we're talking about it, because I asked Ralph Michaels this question last week. I asked him if he rates home court advantage the same in conference tournaments as he would in regular season games, because the dynamics are just a lot different for both of the teams, really.
Yeah, I actually looked at this in the past week. I went back and looked to see in conference tournaments how the favorite does versus the underdog, how the home team does versus the road team. I do keep the numbers the same. It actually looks like going back historically, favorites have covered more often than underdogs in conference tournaments. It surprises me a little bit. You'd think that the underdog would fight pretty hard. But I think that odds makers adjust to the fact that, you know, it's this time of year where everybody would be trying. And you actually get some of these lines where teams would probably be favored by 10 or 11 points, and instead they're favored by 8 or 9. That's my theory, at least, for why the favorites have covered more often than underdogs in the past 10 years when it comes to conference tournaments.
All right, how about the Big South then? And the Big South is very interesting because the first round games played at the higher seeded campus, those are just the bottom four seeds. The quarterfinals and the semifinals are at the home of the number one seed, who is Winthrop here, Winthrop and Rock Hill, South Carolina. They're a minus 115 favorite in this one. UNC Asheville plus 140, these numbers coming from Five Dimes. Everybody else 11 to 1 or higher. So do you feel like this is one of those spots where you can really only pick one of the top two teams?
Yeah, this is a hard one for me. I know that there were some upsets there at the end of the year when it ended up making Winthrop the number one seed. I was hoping I could take Winthrop at plus money because I think they're the best team in this conference. Winthrop had some really tough luck in their games against Asheville this year. I think Winthrop's the most complete team in this conference. I think they're the most likely to win this conference tournament. It's hard for me to find any value here, and I don't really want to lay minus 115 on Winthrop. So, to me, hard to find value in this conference.
I want to touch quickly on this one. Obviously, it's not a conference that you handicap with a whole lot of regularity here. The Northeast Conference. All eight teams in the field here going off at plus money, which should raise some alarm bells for our listeners out there, because when there's not really a clear favorite, I mean, Mount St. Mary's is plus 115. They are the favorite, quote unquote. This is a team that played grueling, horrible non-conference schedule. They were basically gone for like a month or something like that. And you know, just traveled all over the country. It was really hard on the players, but they went 14-4 in conference and 16-15 overall. So to give you an idea of how their non-conference went, but everybody in this league at plus money.
Yeah, I do like one of them here with value. I like LIU Brooklyn plus 360 a decent amount. I think I'll put a small bet on this one. I got to think about whether I want to make this a futures play or a rolling money line, and that's something we can talk about certainly. Mount St. Mary's, you know, to me, deserves to be the favorite, but I do think plus 115 may be a little bit too much. If you look at LIU Brooklyn and how they've done against them in the year, one time they lost to Mount St. Mary's by 2 points at home, and then late in the year, they beat them by 4 points on the road. I like the way Brooklyn's finished out the year here, winning six straight games. Brooklyn didn't play a good non-conference schedule, so that's the weakness of why I don't like them more than I do. But this is a team that's certainly playing their best basketball at the right time of the year. They've won their last four road games. I think Brooklyn has some value there at plus 360.
Let's go ahead and introduce that rolling money line. I think it's something we can talk about a little bit more when we get into some of the bigger conference tournaments, and maybe there are a couple here toward the tail end of this part of the segment that we can use it for. But what do you mean by rolling money line?
Well, first of all, you can take either the futures price or you can take a rolling money line, which means you can just take the money line on that team and keep rolling it over, take the money line the first game, take the money line the second game, you know, and see what that price is going to add up to. You have to try to project out the spread, see what the money line would be in that spot to try to figure out whether you're going to have more value on the futures price or the money line. I think that both of us have agreed on the fact that usually you have more value on the rolling money line. And I think the biggest strength to it for me is that it's so hard to hedge a futures price sometimes. You don't know when to get out, when to keep going. With a rolling money line, it's so easy. I mean, you stop. To me, I lean towards that, especially if I don't know the conference very well. So I think in this case, I'd probably take a rolling money line here with Brooklyn. You know, it's a little bit hard when you don't know a conference really well to be setting spreads on it to know whether you should take one or the other. But like I say, I think probably, you know, 75-80% of the time, the rolling money line is probably going to be the better option.
Yeah, I think so too. And again, we'll have some better examples of where we can use that, you know, in conferences that we know a little bit better. But here's another different type of wagering angle. We'll go to the American East Conference, where Vermont, minus 315 favorite to win this thing. Stony Brook is plus 700. Albany is plus 500. Stony Brook pretty much plays in this conference tournament final just about every single year. Albany won this thing a couple years ago. It was a very emotional. It was a really cool scene, actually, when they won it. This is, again, one of those tournaments that's played at the campus site of the higher-seeded team. But this is one where, let's say you like Albany plus 500. Maybe you like Stony Brook plus 700. Those two very likely to play here in the 2-3 game. These teams do reseed after the quarterfinals, but those teams should take care of business here. The thing about it is, Vermont's going to be such a big favorite in the championship game. They went 16-0 in conference play in the regular season that tying up your money on Albany plus 500, you know, probably not the best thing when you can get them, I would say, somewhere around plus 450, plus 500 if they make it to the championship game.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think it'd probably be plus 500. So I don't understand, you know, the value in playing the future there. Honestly, this is a hard one because I really think Vermont's going to win this conference tournament. I mean, they have really dominated this conference. They haven't even had very many close games here. And against Albany and Stony Brook, they really played well. You know, Stony Brook's been really good in the past, but they had Jameel Warney that he was the best player in this conference. They don't have him anymore. I don't think they're quite good enough. Albany, probably the second best team in this conference. But like you say, I mean, what's the value in taking Albany plus 500? I don't see any.
All right, let's go to the Ohio Valley, because here we actually have a neutral site tournament, and this is another wagering angle that we'll talk about with conference tournaments as we go throughout here. The OVC played at the Nashville Municipal Auditorium. Tennessee State and Belmont are both in Nashville, but neither one of those teams plays their regular season home games here. So it is technically a neutral site, and I know that neutral sites are something that you handicap quite effectively in conference tournaments.
Yeah, you know, I did some pretty solid research here before this segment. I wanted to go back and look at these neutral sites and see which ones of these have been really good to the under, to the over. Nashville Municipal has a name for being a bad shooting backdrop, for being bad for scoring. I will say, I was really interested to find that the over is 22-10, in the last 32 games played here. So it has not been good to unders. I went back and looked at those games more. There have been quite a few first-half unders where the second half has been extremely high in this game. It looks like playing the first half under, second half over, has been a really good way to go about this. I'll look at that more closely. I will say I thought that the under would do better than that here because I know it's not a good shooting backdrop. Having said that, you know, the OVC has a lot of teams in it who foul like crazy. There's going to be a lot of close games. I think there can be some really high-scoring second halves here. So I think this could be a really good wagering angle to look for, is look for spots for first-half unders, second-half overs. You see a low-scoring first half between two teams that usually are high-scoring, you probably get a good opportunity to second-half over.
And you also have some middle opportunities possibly showing up here as well in a conference tournament like this. Belmont, the favorite, minus 160. That's hardly a surprise. They were clearly the best team in the regular season. What I love about this conference is that the number 8 seed Tennessee State, they are the fourth favorite. They're plus 665. They were actually plus 650 along with a couple of other teams when I slapped the odds in my conference tournament previews last night when they came out at five dimes. But watching some of the seeding things here, specifically the tiebreakers and stuff like that, very interesting. Of course, Tennessee State, you know, would run into Belmont if they get to the semifinals. So obviously that's the challenge there with them. But it's just interesting to see a 5 seed at plus 4,000 and then see an 8 seed at plus 650.
Yeah, I think Tennessee State may be the second best team in this conference. Tennessee State played really well in the non-conference slate. Then they just kind of hit a wall there when the conference slate started. I think they played such a difficult non-conference slate. I read some quotes from their coach who basically said their team thought they were better than what they were. Got a little bit of a big head there. And that hurt them in the conference slate. Now, when it comes to the conference tournament, I can't take a team that has to play in that first game. I mean, then you have to play 4 days in a row. I'm not doing that. So I think Tennessee State's a really good team. It won't shock me if they make a little bit of a run here, but I can't take them at that price, at least. I do think if you like Tennessee State, you have to take the rolling money line. It's going to be better than plus 665. There's no doubt about that. What I like best from these futures, I have to take UT Martin at plus 625, given the way this is broken down. You know, the double buy there, so important. UT Martin also stays on the other side from Belmont, obviously. And I do think that this one is one where plus 625 is going to be pretty close to the same price you'd get at a rolling money line. So since you only have two games. So I do like UT Martin plus 625 some. I don't actually think they're going to win this conference tournament. I think Belmont will. But, you know, when you get a double bye, you have to kind of like plus 625.
Well, that leads to a whole different question, and at risk of going really long with this segment, which is becoming more and more of a possibility here. If you take Belmont minus 160 as sort of a quasi-hedge to that plus 625, because Belmont's going to be a significant favorite in the championship game, probably to the point where you don't have enough hedging margin on UT Martin plus 625. So sort of feel like it's almost a pre-tournament hedge because you have that double buy format.
Right, right. I mean, I think you could take both of those if you. I mean, you get a double bye. Now, another topic which we could get started on this too is obviously how good is a double bye for you. Some coaches don't like it because the other team has gotten to play right before that. I think in the end, though, you know, if you get a double bye, you have to be happy about it because it means you only have to play two games to win this conference tournament. So yeah, I think minus 160. And plus 625 makes some sense. I think Morehead State could win this conference tournament, so that's a little bit of a danger of that with UT Martin having to play them right away. Murray State's also a pretty good team, but Murray State's down there in a bad portion of the bracket. You have Murray State and Tennessee State, who are probably two of the best, at least three or four teams in this conference, and they have to play that first game. So that's what makes this really interesting.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the conference tournaments that start later this week, the MAAC, the Colonial, the Horizon, the West Coast, and then also the Summit, conferences that you've handicapped throughout the year, but we don't have any odds out for those. We can talk about them here in a second if you do have some notes that you want to make or maybe some teams that you want people to look for. But let's go to Arch Madness here, Missouri Valley Conference Tournament. So this is really interesting. You've got Wichita State, who's the favorite, at minus 420. Wichita State is the 2 seed. Illinois State at plus 475, the number 1 seed. These two teams split in the regular season. I believe both of them were blowouts, although Wichita State's was much more notable when they blew out Illinois State. This is a really, really hard tournament to handicap because Wichita State, such a big favorite. However, if you're taking one of those teams in the mid-range, 15, 30, 40 to 1, at least you've got some additional hedging value there. You know, when you do get to the final, even though Wichita State's going to be a huge favorite, you know, they're not going to be a minus 2,500 favorite or something like that.
Yeah, I tried hard to find one that I like in that range. I looked at Northern Iowa based on their past success. I don't like Northern Iowa because they rely so much on one guy, Jeremy Morgan. I think you have to have more than one guy in a spot like this, especially against Wichita State and Illinois State, both really good defenses here. I think you could make an argument for Illinois State plus 475 being good value. I'm not sure whether that – I think the money line would probably still be better in that spot too. Wichita State's the best team in this conference. I don't think they deserve to be minus 420 though. Like you said, you know, they split their regular season games, Wichita State and Illinois State. Wichita State just absolutely killed Illinois State at home. You know, I don't have the score right in front of me, but it was pretty epic. Illinois State has the best defense in the conference as far as efficiency. Wichita State quite a bit better than Illinois State on offense. The biggest point I want to make about this conference tournament, though, Scott Trade Center, a tremendous place for unders. I mean, you won't get a better under place, maybe Madison Square Garden, and that's about it. You look back in the past few years, the under is 43-20 in the last 63 games played at the Scott Trade Center. That's an ROI of 32% if you just played the under in every single game. So that's tremendous. The problem with this is that the books are starting to get onto this, and so are a lot of bettors. So if you like the unders in these games, I guarantee you, you want to play the opener because these are going to get bet down hard.
Illinois State lost 86-45 in that rematch against Wichita State. And this is another one of those, though. Now, Illinois State does get a favorable spot by being the number one seed because they're going to play the early game on Friday, which is a bad, bad spot for that 8-9 winner that wins that game. And then they play the late game on Saturday. So Wichita State has a much quicker turnaround with that Friday to Saturday than Illinois State does. But the thing is, why risk plus 475 when that's probably somewhere around the price you'll get for the championship game on Sunday?
Yeah, that'd be my issue with that is, you know, it's probably going to be plus 400 or something like that. So, again, you know, you're risking quite a bit there. Like you say, Illinois State has some advantages. I think that Illinois State is probably the biggest value here, but I don't think that there's any great, you know, futures price to be seen here. Like I say, the unders here are what I would look to, and I also think that the first half unders could have some pretty good value here.
So as I mentioned, the MAAC, the CAA, the Horizon, the West Coast, and the Summit all begin here later this week. We don't have odds up for them. We'll try and get Kyle back on the show here later in the week if we can make that happen. Anything you want to throw out about these five tournaments, you know, just in the event that we can't get you back on the show?
I do, yeah. The MAAC is played at the Times Union Center. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is this a hockey arena?
They have a minor league hockey team, yeah.
Yeah, I think Siena plays their home games here, and then they have a minor league hockey team. If you look on Google, you can look at images of inside the place. It's a really big place compared to what most of these teams are used to playing in. The under 28-9 in the last 37 games played here in conference tournaments. So MAAC tourney is one that I would look to unders. A lot of these teams in the MAAC play really fast. I think you're going to get some pretty high numbers. You get those high unders, it'd be pretty intriguing here because you may catch a, you know, under 158, under 160 in some of these games. And because there's going to be a lot of long jump shots taken based on a tougher shooting backdrop than normal, I like the unders in that one.
One other one I want to mention here, and I want to get your thoughts on this. The Colonial Athletic Association tournament this year at the North Charleston Coliseum. This is the first time that this venue has hosted this event. So how do you play it? Do you feel like the unfamiliarity of a venue negatively impacts a team, or do you have to see, you know, how some of those first round games go? Do you sort of take a conservative approach in year one at a new venue?
I mean, I would think that the under would have more value. Just as we're talking here, I brought it up and looked at the play. I mean, it's a really big arena, 14,000 seats, certainly bigger than what they're used to. I think it's bad for scoring. I think it would probably help the underdogs because lower scoring games. Other than that, I don't have any real extensive thoughts there about that conference tournament. But, yeah, I mean, I think a new venue you're not used to, I think it certainly hurts shooting percentages. And there are some pretty good defenses in this conference to start with.
Well, I think we introduced a lot of really good topics here for conference tournaments. We talked about the money line rollover. We talked about some pre-tournament hedging possibilities in terms of, you know, something like the OVC where you can take that UT Martin spot where they only have to win one game basically to get into the championship. And then you've got Belmont at minus 160, which is a better price than you'd have on the money line in that championship. So we talked about something like that. Talked about shooting backdrops in these neutral sites. You know, there are quirks in a lot of these tournaments. Sometimes teams that are top two seeds will have the day off after their quarterfinal games while the 3-4s play. And then they play the semifinals the following day. So there's a lot of different things like that. I wrote up all of these conference tournaments that are starting here this week at bangthebook.com, except for the SoCon because they still have games tonight. But there's previews and some of my predictions for these events over there at the website. So please check those out. And again, we'll see if we can get Kyle back on the show later in the week for some of those other, you know, those conferences that he's been handicapping throughout the year. It's a little bit challenging with the America East, the A-Sun, the Big South. These games aren't always lines, so they're not conferences that, you know, everyone pays close attention to. But even though conference tournaments are starting here this week, we still have the regular season for a lot of these leagues. I mean, there's another, I think, 10 or 12 rounds of conference tournaments that start next week because there's still regular season action left to finish up. We're going to go to Conference USA here. We want to hit on three games that are coming up this week. You want to talk about Western Kentucky and North Texas.
Yeah, Western Kentucky and North Texas. You know, this is a possible premium look-ahead. I will say, too, I had a couple premium look-aheads last week that ended up being top-rated plays for me. Both of those cashed with the Long Beach under last week and then UConn. UConn was one of the craziest games I've ever seen as far as the finish of that game. Looked like it was going to be a bad beat on UConn, and then they threw in a three right at the end of the game, and we got the cover. So glad that those two look-aheads worked out well. This is a possible premium look ahead. I like the over in this game, and I'm going to give you the reason I like the over, and I think that this is one that can apply to a lot of games this week, so keep this one in mind. I like playing overs here late in the season. I've gone back and back-tested this. This is certainly an angle that works really well. Two teams who really have nothing to play for in their last couple games of the regular season, you know, they're not a really good team. They say they're around 500 or worse. You know, in spots like this, you get some really high-scoring games in the last week of the season. The over has done much better than the under in those spots because even teams that play slow pick up their tempo a little bit. They play a little bit more free. It's a spot where, as we've talked about in the past, these teams are really looking forward to the conference tournament. They don't really have anything more to play for in the regular season. So, you know, you look forward to that conference tournament. And when you're not really too invested in that game, there's a lot more scoring than when you care a lot about that game. So remember that one going forward. I think that this could be a good spot to play the over. North Texas is really pushing the tempo here lately. North Texas is not a good team. Western Kentucky is really bad defensively, 281st in the country out of 351 on defensive efficiency. I mean, you get some really bad defense in a game like this. You get a total that's probably going to be mid-140s, something like that. And I think that we could see the offenses perform better than normal here.
Let me ask you this, and North Texas is a team that's going to fall into this here this week because only the top 12 teams in the 14-team Conference USA make the conference tournament. So North Texas and FIU both mathematically eliminated. Their seasons will end when they play their last regular season game. So for North Texas here, that'll be the case for them on March 4th when they play at Marshall. So when you look at a team like that that has, you know, no games left to play after the final, how do you view them? I mean, is that a team where you look at them and say, okay, well, you know, look, let's be honest, they were shitty during the season, so they're probably happy that it's over. Or do you feel like some of these kids are going to go, hey, this is our last college basketball game. You know, let's step up and play well here.
That's a really hard question to answer. Really, really hard. I've never really figured out the answer to that. I'm just going to be totally honest. I like to pass in that situation, honestly. You know, I think there are better spots than playing a game like that. I guess I'd be a little bit more tempted to take the points in a game like that with North Texas playing their final game. But, you know, I feel like North Texas doesn't have a very good coach. They're not coached up very well. They don't play any better at the end of the year than they did at the beginning of the year. I mean, there could be some spots where I'd like to take the points in a spot like that because, you know, if the coach is a decent coach, you have a lot of seniors who really care a lot. But I'm not sure that North Texas would fit into that. And like I say, I think that's a really, really hard question to answer. I think that you could ask a lot of handicappers that question and get a different answer.
All right, let me ask you this. Let me ask you, because it is a case-by-case basis type of thing, so obviously, you know, it's going to be different for each program. North Texas is terrible. That's why they're not going to their conference tournament. Take a look at a team like Northern Colorado, for example. Self-imposed postseason ban. They had some program violations, so they decided, you know what, we're just going to go ahead and call it a year here when we wrap up the regular season. They gave it their all against North Dakota. They lost in overtime by 3. North Dakota, the top team in the Big Sky. Northern Colorado's got 2 home games left, Portland State, Sacramento State. Different, you know, based on the reason why a team's not going to the postseason?
Yeah, I like Northern Colorado more than I would like the average team. I think that Northern Colorado would fight harder. I like this example. That's a really good example, Adam. I think that Northern Colorado has proven time and time again here in the Big Sky Conference, but even though they're not a good team, they've played some really good teams tough. They've taken North Dakota to overtime twice. They actually should have won both of those games. They played Weber close on the road. Weber's a really good team in this conference. You know, this is a team that I think is a little bit better than their record. And I do think that in this kind of case, they're going to fight pretty hard, especially at home in those last two games. The problem is you're not going to be able to catch points with them here. Maybe against Portland State, it'll be about a pick-em, something like that. They're going to be favored against Sacramento State. I mean, I'd rather take a team like that catching points than I would laying points, that's for sure.
Well, and again, you can look around for some of those teams. I mentioned some of them in my overall college conference tournament preview. That's down below the individual conferences. But there are some teams that are missing due to self-imposed bans, low APR scores, transitioning to D1, all kinds of stuff like that. So there are some teams that, you know, will not be playing in the postseason. Then, of course, there are some teams that just don't qualify for the conference tournament because they weren't good enough. So those are things that you can look for out there in the betting market. Let's go to another one of these games here that you wanted to talk about. We'll go out to the Big West. UC Davis, UC Irvine, big one here on Saturday night. Irvine, the home team for this one.
Yeah, I like the Big West as a conference. This conference has been really good to me in the past. I've made good money betting it. You know, the Big West is a unique conference. There's a lot of teams that play slow here. There's a lot of teams that play really fast. You can get some really big pace wars. I really like games like that. I think Irvine's the best team in this conference. Both Irvine and Davis are 11-5 at this point. Now, they will have played another game before that, so we don't know what their record will be there. But I think this is going to be a game that matters quite a bit. Irvine lost at Davis 74-65. Here earlier in the year, but the really big key to me, Luke Nelson didn't play in that game. Luke Nelson is the best player for UC Irvine. He's also probably the best player in this conference, at least looking forward to a possible professional future, something like that. Luke Nelson is a guy that can get his own shot really well, a good jump shooter, a guy that can also go to the hoop and get the free throw line where he shoots it well. At least he has shot it well overall. I see he's only 69% so far this year. But Nelson's a really good player. UC Irvine's a team that plays good defense. If you look at UC Davis, too, they're a team that I've looked at pretty closely. Like I said, my top play on Saturday was on the under with UC Davis and Long Beach State. That was a game we talked about last week. That one actually went into overtime, and it still stayed under the total. I was watching that game. It may have made me lose a year or so off my life, but I did win the under, so that's a good thing. It's one of these spots where I think UC Davis has been really good at home. UC Davis, though, on the road, they lost to UC Riverside by 6. They lost to Cal Poly by 4. Those are two of the worst teams in this conference. I think UC Irvine has some revenge here. I think UC Irvine is going to be a decent favorite, hopefully not too big of a favorite, because I'd like to lay the points here with Irvine, especially if we can catch something like maybe 6 or 7 points. If it's up in the 9 or 10 point range, I'll have to pass.
And there can be a pretty big advantage to being the number one seed in the Big West, because this is one of those that reseeds for the semifinals. So if you somehow get 7 to knock off 2 or 6 to knock off 3, something like that, your path probably a little bit easier to the championship game if you're the number one seed. I mean, we've seen it in the past, though, with the Big West where, last year the top 4 seeds all held up. But in 2015, you had 5 win over 4. I think there was a couple of years ago where 8 actually knocked off 1. So, it is one of those things where seeding does matter. Some of these conferences, it doesn't really matter. You don't get too much of an advantage. Other times you do. In the Big West, it certainly does matter. And it looks like the Big West, top seed will be on the line here probably in this game. I don't know what the tiebreakers are in the Big West, but, it looks like that could be an angle here for that matchup. One more game that you wanted to touch on here, and it's pretty obvious why you want to talk about this one. Purdue and Northwestern, the poor Wildcats, they've done everything they can to get on the bubble, then get themselves over the bubble. Now they're back on it. This poor team, man, I just want to see them make the tournament.
Oh, I'm definitely rooting for Northwestern to make the tournament. Yeah, I just keep thinking, man, here they look good. They look good. They should be fine. And then they lose several games, and now they're on the bubble again. I have to say the Big Ten's really not very good this year, at least at the top. Big Ten has depth this year. There's no really bad teams in the conference. Rutgers is pretty bad. But in general, the Big Ten has depth, but really no really good teams at the top, especially with Wisconsin not playing well at all here lately. If you look at Northwestern, though, the problem for me is that Northwestern doesn't seem to match up very well against Purdue. Northwestern doesn't have that much really good interior defense. Purdue, a really, really big front line. They're just tremendous. They can get a lot of offensive rebounds. They can score on the inside. Caleb Swanigan, a really, really good player. He has a good pro future ahead of him. And Isaac Haas, also very good, and he's 7'2". And the first game between these two was 80-59. Purdue really shot the ball well from long range in that game. And, I think that Purdue is unlikely to shoot it so well from long range in this game. And also, I believe Northwestern was without Scotty Lindsey in that first game, and that'll help them quite a bit to have him back. Northwestern can ill afford to lose these last two games at home against Michigan and Purdue. They have to win at least one of those games. And really, neither one of those games are easy games. Michigan playing pretty well right now. I worry about them here. Purdue's going to be favored. My lean would be Purdue. I don't think this will be a premium play. I more wanted to talk about it for the fact that Northwestern, they have a ton of pressure on them here. I don't know if that helps or hurts here because, you say they have a lot to play for, but they also have a ton of pressure on them, which could certainly be a negative.
Yeah, that could be a big-time negative. I mean, if they win the Michigan game, maybe it changes the dynamic a little bit. 21 wins, 10 in conference play, that might be enough to get them there, and maybe they can relax a little bit. But still, it's very hard to relax. Now, of course, they do have the Big Ten tournament, where if they win a couple of games in that, they should be in decent shape. But you want to try and lock this thing up as early as you can if you're Northwestern. And beating Purdue would probably do it, I would have to think. Purdue owns the tiebreaker over Wisconsin, so they should win the Big Ten regular season. So if you knock off the Big Ten regular season champ, you're probably in. So lots of moving parts here in college basketball over the next couple of weeks. Conference tournaments, obviously, and then we start a bunch of conference tournaments again next week, so lots of things to look forward to there. Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com, what's going on over at the website right now?
Well, certainly excited about this time of the year. I'm going to be a lot of plays here between now and the end of college basketball season. I've been doing well in NBA here lately. I did want to touch on the facts here lately. I've actually gotten some questions from people. I'm on 18-4 run in NBA in the last 22. Some people have asked me, why aren't you playing more NBA games? Why aren't you pushing NBA more than college basketball? It's one of those sample size things. You look back and you look at year after year after year, what have I been good at? College basketball has been a lot better to me than the NBA. I've changed up some things in the NBA, and I certainly think I'm a better NBA handicapper now than I used to be. But still, I don't want to push a recent run more than I want to push something that I've done well on long term. I do have a special that I'm going to give here. $400 for the rest of the year, basketball, all NBA, all college basketball. It's going to be a lot of plays there. You can contact me, Kyle at huntersportspicks.com or at KyleHunterPicks about that special.
Well, Kyle, a joy as always. Again, we'll see if we can work this out logistically to get you on the program again later in the week. If not, good luck with everything this week, man, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Thanks, man.
Good stuff there from Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. Coming up on Tuesday, our regular Tuesday meeting show, we'll chat with Brian Leonard of wagertalk.com. Also go hunting for winners with Sports Cheetah of wagertalk.com. A couple of things I want to mention here personally. Over at bangthebook.com, as I mentioned during that segment there with Kyle, I'm writing up conference tournament previews for every single conference. So a lot of work going in here, lots of writing done over the weekend, lots of writing still to come. I've got about 15 of my season win totals finished for MLB. Those will start rolling out here early in the week. I need to check and see if all the sports books that I've listed in those write-ups do have the win total odds out. If they do, we'll start getting those posted here probably this afternoon or tomorrow. Just want to make sure that, you know, you have access to these numbers as you're looking at them. But lots of writing, very, very busy time of the year for me. If you have any questions, any feedback, please hit me up on Twitter at Skating Tripods. Happy to respond to anything here on the air, you know, or respond to anything on Twitter, however you want it to be done. But that'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.